Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hi. Hello. My name is Chrissy Champagne, and you are listening to Residue, a true crime podcast dedicated to keeping you paranoid. More than usual this week, I have been walking around my house just singing Taylor Swift. But it's not because the new album came out, it's because of this story. So, when she talks about some vigilante shit, we're going to really be talking about some of that vigilante shit today. And this is the case of Marianne Bachmeier. What is being a vigilante? It is the act of preventing, investigating, and punishing perceived offenses and crimes without legal authority. A vigilante is a person who takes the law into their own hands when they believe that the law is not doing enough to ensure justice. We talked about this in a previous episode, the case of Gary Plouchet and Jody Plouchet. And people have differing opinions on whether or not it is the right of the parent to take the life of their child's abuser. I believe most people stand on the side of the parent. And it's been a huge debate for years, for decades. Is it okay to take justice into your own hands? A hero and a vigilante could be the same thing. A hero is a more simplified term for a large group of people who are doing good. But a vigilante is someone who also fights for justice and wants to do good, but they don't follow the law to do so. Marianne Bachmeier was born on July 3rd, 1950. And when you look at her past, you realize that Marianne did not have a very cozy life, even from the start. Her parents were forced to flee from East Prussia during World War II, and as a child, she lived in Sarstedt, West Germany. Marianne's father was a member of the Waffen-SS, which was the combat portion of the Nazis' SS unit. The Waffen-SS was based on the racist ideology of Nazism. On top of all that, Marianne is being raised in a home that is extremely conservative and her parents are very religious. Her father was also a very heavy drinker and he spent much of his time at a bar instead of at home with his family. But when he would return home from the bar, he was a very violent and aggressive man. Marianne's mother realizes this and she can't handle it anymore. She can't live in this type of household with this anger and this hostility. So she divorces Marianne's father, but she ends up marrying again. And this time, it's not that much different than it was the first time around. Marianne is now a teenager and now she has a stepfather who is just as abusive as her biological father. He would call her names, he would beat her, and her mother wouldn't stick up for her. In fact, what happens is her mother and her stepfather end up kicking Marianne out of the house as a teenager at 15 years old. It's no surprise that Marianne ends up becoming a very independent and feisty young woman who basically, you know, isn't going to settle for your shit. And this is all because of the way that she was brought up. I mean, when you think about it, you have to realize like how horrible it had to have been for her to have no one on her side. It had to always feel like there was not one person that had her back. At only 16 years old, Marianne becomes pregnant. Now, she knows that she is not fit to be a mother at this point in time. She has nowhere to live. She is a teenager. She knew the right decision for her was that she should give this baby up for adoption. So she does. A couple years later, Marianne becomes pregnant again for the second time. This is by the age of 18, and this is with her boyfriend at the time, her high school boyfriend. She wanted to keep this baby, and she thought that if the two of them stayed together, they could make this work. It was a little farther on into her pregnancy when Marianne was raped while pregnant. She decides that she is also not emotionally or mentally prepared to care for this child, and she gives this child up for adoption also. It is now 1972. Marianne has taken a job at a bar in town, and she's about 22 years old at this point. She becomes a waitress and realizes how much she loves this lifestyle. Like, she loves the late nights, sleeping in all day. She ends up dating the bar manager named Christian, and they have an on-again, off-again relationship. There is a lot of cheating. There are a lot of one-night stands, and it wasn't your conventional lovey-dovey relationship. Marianne is sort of a fan favorite at the bar. Everyone comes in to see her. She loves all the attention. She's making money. She ends up getting pregnant at this time for the third time. And this time she is like, I am keeping this baby. This is my baby. I will do this on my own if I have to. And that's what she ends up doing. Her boyfriend at the time, Christian, just said that he wasn't ready to commit to a serious relationship right now, and Marianne was fine with that. She said, I'll do this alone. And that is when, on November 14th, 1972, Marianne's daughter, Anna, was born. Immediately after Anna is born, Marianne decides to have a tubal ligation, or tying the tubes. A woman who has this surgery can no longer get pregnant, and this means she is sterile. Being a single mother, Marianne is going to have to work, and sometimes this would mean that she was going to have to bring Anna to the bar with her. The locals would say that Anna was also a staple at the bar, and a lot of times after school ended, Marianne would just bring Anna to work with her, and it wasn't like she would rush home after work ended. It would be known that Anna would be sometimes sleeping in some of the booths or at the bar. And when Marianne would finish her shifts, she wouldn't take Anna home and get her to bed because she had school the next day. She would just figure, well, she's already asleep, so I'll just kind of hang out here and have some drinks with my friends. Kind of treating Anna more like a younger sister than a child that you have to raise. Anna was alone a lot. Anna was learning a sense of independence very quickly. She was only 7 years old at this point, but she could get herself up for school, get herself ready for school, get herself to school, do her homework alone. Basically, Anna is growing up pretty quickly. It also starts to get to the point for Marianne that she realizes that she's not giving Anna the type of life that that little girl deserves. So she ends up looking into the foster care system and even talks to a family for a brief period of time about possibly taking Anna and raising her as their own. On the night of May 4th, 1980, it's a Sunday night, Anna and Marianne get into an argument. And like I said earlier, they may have been arguing more like two sisters would, and it probably got pretty intense. And Anna goes to bed. They both go to bed. They wake up in the morning. Anna has to go to school now. So she doesn't even go into her mother's room and try to wake her up because she's still upset with her. And Marianne, you know, possibly still a little drunk or hungover from the night before, doesn't get up. She stays in bed. And Anna is like, I'll just take myself to school. No, you know what? I'm not going to go to school. How about that? You know what? That's how I'll get my mother back. I'm going to skip school today. Marianne wakes up. She realizes that Anna has left for the day. Obviously, she's at school, so okay. Marianne has some things to do that day. She actually had a photo shoot planned for the local newspaper. She had a really cool, artistic-looking Volkswagen van, and they wanted to do a little story on her. So she was getting ready for this interview. She was getting her makeup done, trying to look cute for the newspapers, and she realizes, you know what? Anna will come home later after school. I'll apologize. We'll talk about it then. But Anna never returns home from school. It is now nighttime on May 5th, 1980, and Anna is still not home from school. So Marianne goes to the police station and she files a missing persons report. The next morning on May 6th, 1980, a woman enters the police station and tells the police that she knows who killed Anna Bachmeier. She tells them that it was her fiancé, Klaus Grabowski. Klaus Grabowski was a 35-year-old man who lived next door to Marianne and Anna. Klaus Grabowski was a convicted sex offender, and he had previously been sentenced for the sexual abuse of two young girls. But in 1976, he voluntarily submitted to chemical castration. Chemical castration is castration via drugs, whether to reduce libido and sexual activity, to treat cancer. Unlike surgical castration, chemical castration does not remove organs and it is not a form of sterilization. In men, chemical castration reduces the sex drive and the capacity for sexual arousal. This form of castration was used as a way to avoid incarceration. Okay, so now Klaus is free, and what happens? He meets a woman, and he falls in love with this woman, and they're together for a while before he realizes he wants to start a family with her. They want to get married, and he ends up going to see a doctor and asking for his castration to be reversed, which this doctor does. Gives him some medication to reverse the chemical castration so that Grabowski can just go on living the same exact life that he used to live. But this time he is living that life next door to 7-year-old Anna Bachmeier. Klaus's new fiance had no idea about any of this, and luckily and thankfully, she went straight to the police and told them that he confessed to her. So the police take Klaus, they arrest him. He is now in jail, and he is now going to tell the police exactly what happened that day when he saw Anna Bachmeier on the street. On May 5th, 1980, when Anna woke up, she decided, I'm not going to school today to spite my mother. So she thinks, you know what? I'll go over to my friend's house and I'll hang out with her all day. So she goes over to her friend's house, knocks on the door, and realizes her friend's at school. All of her friends are going to be at school. So she didn't really think this through. She decides, you know what? I'll just go home. She starts to walk home and she sees Klaus Grabowski standing outside of his home. He's home alone. His fiance's at work and he has a cat. And he knows that Anna loves to play with their cat. So he asks her if she just wants to come inside and play with the cat for a little bit. What is sad is that we will never truly know what went on behind those closed doors. We know what Klaus tells us, and some of what he does tell us is infuriating, it's ridiculous, it's insane. On the first day of court, Klaus says that he killed Anna. He was quoted as saying that he strangled her with his fiancé's pantyhose and that he, quote, heard something come out of her nose. I was fixated, then I could not stand the sight of her body any longer. After he strangled her, he put her in a box, and then he rode his bike with that box to a canal to bury her. Klaus would claim that he never touched Anna. He also blames Anna. He says that Anna blackmailed him. He said Anna tried to seduce him, and he rejected her. And then Anna said if he didn't give her money, then she was going to run home and tell her mother what he did to her. Which, according to Klaus, was absolutely nothing, because this 7-year-old came into his home and not only seduced him, but blackmailed him. Okay, Klaus. By the third day of the trial, Marianne cannot take this anymore. She is so sick of sitting here and listening to this scum talk about her daughter the way that he was, lying to everyone in that courtroom, and then just having to hear the details. It was said that Marianne overheard someone in the courtroom talking about the fact that they were going to have to do an extra day and they were going to have Klaus get back on the stand and he was going to testify again to what he did to Anna. And Marianne was like, I'm not sitting through this again. I cannot do this again. So on the third day of the trial, she smuggled a .22 caliber Beretta pistol in her purse, walked straight in to the courtroom, stood directly behind Klaus, raised the gun, and shot the gun 8 times. Klaus Grabowski was hit 6 times and ultimately died on the courtroom floor in a pool of his own blood. The judge recalled Marianne saying, I wanted to kill him. He killed my daughter. I wanted to shoot him in the face, but I shot him in the back. I hope he's dead. Marianne was quoted as saying that she saw visions of Anna in the courtroom before shooting Klaus Grabowski. She said that she could no longer take him telling lies about her daughter. This incident would go on to become one of the most well-known cases of vigilante justice in West German history. It sparked so much media coverage, television crews from around the country and overseas traveled to report on this case, and Marianne Bachmeier became known as Revenge Mother. Marianne would eventually sell her story to Stern magazine for the equivalent of $158,000, and this was just in order to pay her defense attorney fees. Ultimately, the courts would convict Marianne Bachmeier of premeditated manslaughter in 1983, and she was sentenced to 6 years behind bars. When Marianne was first convicted, she had an outpouring of support from everyone in the community, everyone across the country, across the world. People really supported her, sent her gifts. She was given flowers. And then the Stern magazine article comes out and people are able to read about her earlier life, the adoptions, the leaving Anna at the bar, not really being now portrayed as that innocent of a mother. So a lot of people still stayed on her side and still believed in what she did, but a lot of people also really became harsh critics of Marianne. Marianne would end up spending 3 years in prison and she would be released. After she was released, she ended up marrying a school teacher in 1985. The newly married couple would then move to Nigeria, and they lived in a German camp where her husband taught at a German school. Sadly, though, they would divorce in 1990. Soon after, Marianne would be diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and she would return to Germany. On September 17th, 1996, Marianne Bachmeier died at the age of 46 from pancreatic cancer. She is buried next to her daughter, Anna. In 2006, a documentary was made about the case, and a former friend stated that Marianne rehearsed the shooting in the basement of the bar she worked at after Anna was murdered. Marianne Bachmeier never expressed remorse for her act of vengeance against Klaus Grabowski. Thank you so much for tuning in this week again to Residue. I hope you will join me again next week. And don't forget to find me on all the social media pages. Instagram, Residue Podcast. Facebook, Residue, A True Crime Podcast. And then also, maybe if you were just feeling a little cool, you would leave me a review, a 5-star review. Or, you know what? Buzzsprout has this new thing where you can send me fan mail. Let's try it. You can write me anything. Just write me a little note. Also, you cannot forget to stay safe and stay paranoid.
To have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Chumba. Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus terms and conditions apply.